Perfect. All right. Back on the Meadow View appeal hearing to February 10th, 2025, 10:40 a.m. We just finished cross examination of Mr. Kindred by Mr. Telgen, and Ms. Kolesnikova now may have some redirect.
Thank you, Mr. Examiner. I do not have any redirect.
Oh, okay. Perfect. All right. Well, Mr. Telgen, who's our next witness then?
And while we're waiting, I think he had asked for
Where
Ms.
is that?
Decker.
I can pull her over
Okay. All right. Let's bring her
and I
up to get
confirm on the
ready.
break she's on. Just to
Oh.
limit technical issues. Sorry about that.
Yeah, I just need to get Mr. Telgen on. Let's see.
I don't see him on the attendee list either.
Yeah, let's give him a few minutes, of course.
And I'll resend him his panel's link too, just in case.
There he is. All right. Okay, Mr. Telgen. So, Ms. Kolesnikova said she didn't need to do any redirect. So, we're moving on to Ms. Decker at this point. Let's see if we got Mr. Director, Ms. Decker up. Oh, there she is. Okay, Ms. Decker, just raise your right hand. You swear affirm, tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding.
I do.
Okay, great. All right, go ahead, Mr. Telgen.
Let's see. Still good morning, Mrs. Decker, or Miss Decker. I'm going to put up on the screen your. So this is a January 30th, 2025 letter that I believe you authored. Do you recognize this?
Yes, I do.
Okay, Miss Jones, do you know what comp what exhibit number this is?
I believe this is Terra Associates rebuttal letter. This is F101.
F101. Thanks. So, Ms. Decker, I'm going to jump down to page two, and you have this attachment, you have this response to attachment B to my previous comment letter from January 24th, 2025, where you talk about Dr. Rosine's attachment to that letter. And I understand this to be a criticism of how Dr. Rosine views the sort of measured infiltration rate on the site. Is that accurate?
It's a criticism of his equating an infiltration rate to saturated hydraulic conductivity.
Okay. And then my understanding from this is that, let me see, where do you say it here? Sorry. I'm focusing on this sentence right here where you say these two factors are critical in determining a measured infiltration rate. And I believe those two factors are the hydraulic conductivity plus the hydraulic gradient. Is that
Correct.
accurate?
Yes.
Okay. And I think this, so this, in the context of things, this goes to an issue that was discussed at the SEPA hearing, which has to do with whether or not infiltration is technically feasible on the project site in accordance with the protocols in the Kitsap County Stormwater Design Manual. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Okay. And I'm going to go to, I'm going to switch my screens here for just one moment. I guess first I'll ask you, in your mind, is there a difference between a measured infiltration rate and a design infiltration rate?
Yes.
And what is that?
So a measured infiltration rate is the sort of what you're going to get during an initial field study. It's going to be the essentially the hydraulic conductivity of a material times the hydraulic gradient, which is basically how is this water going to come from wherever you've put it in and move through a soil formation. The design infiltration rate takes that measured infiltration rate and applies additional correction factors based on the testing that you've used, the variability of site soils, and the ability of the soils to clog during when the facility is in production.
Okay. And then I'm going to share my screen here. This is what I'm going to be showing you is the sort of online version of the Kitsap County Stormwater Design Manual. Can you see my screen?
I can.
Let me see here. How about if I, 'cause I have to make the well, I have to make space on my desktop. Just one second. Okay, can you still see it?
Yeah.
All right. And so when I was talking to Ms. Hevren, we were talking about this is Volume 2, Section 5.3.2 of the Kitsap County Stormwater Design Manual. And it talks about effectively how to make these determinations about measured infiltration rates, design infiltration rates, et cetera. And we were talking, when I was talking with her, we were talking about step three, which was conduct infiltration testing. Have you reviewed this part of the manual?
I haven't reviewed it intimately, but I'm familiar with it.
Fair enough. And when I was talking to her, she had referenced this particular table. This is table 2-5.5. And she had referenced this table as the reason why infiltration was not feasible on this site as a site-wide sort of BMP. And the reason she gave is that dry wells, well, for either dry wells or infiltration trenches, it has this statement here that to be feasible, you have to have a measured infiltration rate of at least 5 inches per hour. Do you understand that?
Yes.
Okay. And I'm sorry, I'm not trying to like foist Ms. Hevren's testimony. I'm just trying to put this in the context of why I'm interested in this question. Because I understand the applicant and Ms. Hevren to be saying, you know, infiltration's not feasible because it's below that 5 inch per hour threshold, right? And then they're relying on your calculations of the infiltration rate. So I'm just sort of putting this in context for the questions that I'm going to be asking you, okay?
Okay.
And this table refers to a measured infiltration rate, not a design rate. So I'm interested in figuring out how the manual goes about calling for the calculation of a measured infiltration rate and then how you did it. Okay.
Okay.
And then I'm going to, fortunately, I don't think there's a way to prevent having to keep run, jumping back and forth, but I'm going to jump back to your testimony or your comment letter. And then we have this chart that is in your most recent comment letter, exhibit F101. And this is on page 3. Can you tell me what we're looking at here?
This is the results of our an Excel spreadsheet that we've created to perform the grain size methodology for determining an infiltration rate.
Okay. And so the grain size methodology, you're trying to figure out sort of how quickly or how efficiently, I'm not sure what the right word is, water moves will move through the native soil media. And instead of doing a test where you actually go out there and dig a pit and pour water in and measure it, you sort of take the soil, you figure out its sort of physical properties, and from there you can derive the infiltration rate. Is that roughly accurate?
I'd say that's fairly accurate.
Okay. And this chart is sort of broken up, it seems to me, into three sort of components. The first one is this box up here. The second one, I guess I would say this box right here. And then the third one is this down here. Yes? Or is
Yes.
that roughly right? And it just sort of big picture on this diagram, where could I find the measured infiltration rate?
Measured infiltration rate is at the very bottom where it says F inches per hour 4.3.
4.3. Okay. And so what is this first box up here?
That's using the Massman equation to determine the hydraulic conductivity of a or permeability of the various soil samples that we took from around the site.
Okay. And let's see, make sure I'm just going to, I think I can swap back and forth more easily. Desktop, do you still see my do you see my screen where my cursor is?
It's still on my Excel spreadsheet.
Okay, very good. So now I'm going to flip back, and then can you still see it right here too?
Yes.
Great. That this will be the better way to do it. So I'm going to go back to this. This is again section 5.3.2 of the Kitsap County Stormwater Design Manual, and we're looking at step three. And I'm looking at step three because it says this manual includes five allowed methods of field infiltration testing to determine the measured infiltration rate. So this is the step under the manual where you determine the measured infiltration rate, which is what you would compare to that earlier 5 inches per hour figure I showed you for determining feasibility. Okay.
Yes.
And step four talks about the design infiltration rate, and it says the design rate is different from the infiltration or from the measured rate in turn because the design rate is used for BMP sizing calculations. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay, so the measured rate is different from the design rate because the design rate, so the measured rate's for feasibility, the design rate is for sizing. Is that accurate?
Not necessarily. You need a design rate even in a feasibility setting so that if you've determined that infiltration is feasible, you need to do some preliminary sizing and some locations to so that you can follow that next step and get more accurate field testing, which is typically done after you've gone through kind of a preliminary plat process. It's like, okay, here's where we can do it. Here's where we think it works. Okay, go out and actually confirm these infiltration rates using, either the same methodology that you used before or a different methodology based on what you've done before. So I don't know that they're separate from what needs to be done in terms of a feasibility study, but they're certainly different rates.
And when we talk about sizing, what does that kind of refer to?
That's what does the size of the facility need to be? You've got so much water coming into a facility. This is how quickly it will leave based on the design infiltration rate. And how big does your facility need to be?
And I can understand that, because I think there are some things called infiltration ponds, right? Where you have a big sort of open pond, and then it's designed to have the water infiltrate below. I can kind of understand sizing in that size. In that sense, but what would sizing mean, say, in the context of like a dry well?
A dry well, it's the same concept. You have so much water going into the dry well, and it's only going to leave at a specific rate. So if you have more water coming in and you do not have the storage in the dry well to allow the water to go out, you're just going to fill up that dry well and it's going to overtop and you're going to end up with water in areas where you don't want it.
But how does the dry well size change? Like, does it get wider or deeper or what?
It can go multiple directions. I've seen them go wider. I've seen them go deeper. Typically, when they go wider, you just switch to an infiltration trench instead of a drywall.
Okay. All right. And then this section, this is step three on determining the measured infiltration rate. It directs you to an appendix G to the Kitsap County Stormwater Design Manual. So I'm going to go there. And now we're in Appendix G. And I'm going to, let's see here. I'm going to go down to determining the measured initial KSAT. Do you see that?
You do.
And then they have different sections for small infiltration test, pilot infiltration test, et cetera, and then grain size analysis. Do you see that?
You do.
Okay, so I'm going to go to the grain size analysis. And this has a series of equations for determining the initial KSAT. Now, first of all, is the initial KSAT the same as the measured, or is the KSAT the same as the measured infiltration rate?
No.
No. Okay, so here we have equation G1, estimate initial saturated hydraulic conductivity, and you see this equation right here.
Yes.
What is that?
That's the Massman equation.
That's the Massman equation. And what are the, and so I see there's a value. This is the saturated hydraulic conductivity. And then we have various numbers you add it to or minus it to. What are all those?
So the Massman equation was developed and utilized to determine the saturated hydraulic conductivity of soils based on their individual grain sizes. The coefficients that you see in front of the D10, the D60, the D90, and then the fines content, those were developed over time through various testing that was conducted. Once they were done, they said, okay, these are the coefficients that you apply to your D10, your D60, your D90, and your fines. And those are what you find completing a grain size analysis. And what they essentially mean is the D10 is the percentage that was passing the number 10 sieve. The D60 is the percent passing the 60, 90. And then the fines content is the percent passing the 200. And so you take all that information, you put it in the equation using the appropriate coefficients. I would note that this particular equation gives you results in centimeters per second. Mm-hmm. So that is slightly different than the one that you will see in our Excel spreadsheet.
Right. And so if I go back to your Excel spreadsheet, I think if I'm correct, that equation's right here.
Correct.
Okay. So this box, if I'm understanding it correctly, where you result in ksat feet per day, is doing that same step but resulting in feet per day versus centimeters per second?
Correct.
Okay. And otherwise, same formula.
Correct.
Okay. And then you have at these various test pits, you then have a result in terms of the ksat at these various locations ranging from 202.52, it looks like down to 22.64.
Yes.
Okay. And what exactly do those numbers represent? You call it the potential hydrologic conductivity.
It's the permeability of the soil. It's how fast do we think that water will move through that particular formation?
Okay. So that was the first step in the procedure. And then they have this other one. This is still under the concept of determining the measured ksat. And we have, you see this equation G2, saturated hydraulic conductivity using the harmonic mean?
Yes.
Uh-huh. What is that?
So in a soil formation, you can have various hydraulic conductivities even within a single test pit. And so what this does is it takes those hydraulic conductivities and it gives them essentially a weighted average. It's, you know, the top 5 feet is a very high permeability. Then you have 2 feet of a lower permeability, but still permeable. And then underneath that, you have another 5 feet of a different level of permeability. And this equation allows you to take that into consideration when you're looking at a single test pit. This is in our Excel spreadsheet. We just do not utilize it in this particular case because our formations were fairly uniform within the individual test pits.
Okay. And so this equation G2, I won't try and pronounce it. It's a mathematical equation. But that appears to me to be this equation right here.
Yes.
Okay. So that section, that equation G2, which is the harmonic mean, that is this box.
No, you went too far. It stops at the dark orange.
Right there?
Nope. Look, the dark orange color.
Isn't that the dark orange color?
Yeah, it goes all the way to the edge of that. It doesn't. There's another little box right outside of that says K equivalent average.
Oh.
That isn't included in that equation.
I see. So where's your result from that equation?
As I just stated, we didn't use it in this particular instance because the formations that we were seeing in the individual test pits did not change. So we didn't have a weighted harmonic mean. It wasn't necessary in this case.
I see. So you did the K equivalent average instead.
Yeah, it's just a straight average.
It's a straight average of these numbers. Although it doesn't include the 22.64.
Or the 28.04. This particular one also excluded test pit 10.
I see. Okay, so that is the average of all of these except for the two lowest.
Correct.
Okay. And then I'm going to go back to, so then we sort of reached the end of the section on sorry, determining the immeasured initial ksat in Appendix G. And then we go on to calculation of the design infiltration rate. That's subsection G4 of Appendix G. I'm going to click on that. And have you reviewed this section of the stormwater design manual?
Not in detail, no.
Okay. So there's two approaches. I'm going to go through them. One is the simplified approach. And it talks about taking that ksat and adding certain correction factors or CFs. Is that something you're familiar with?
Yes.
Okay. And for this particular method of doing it, it says assume that the ksat is the measured infiltration rate for the native soils.
Yes.
Okay. So I thought earlier you said the ksat was not the measured infiltration rate,
It's not.
but it says here that it is.
It says it's an initial infiltration rate. You can certainly start by looking at that, but hydraulic conductivity, ksat, and infiltration rates are different. You must
Oh.
apply a hydraulic conduct you must apply a hydraulic gradient to a how to a saturated hydraulic conductivity in order to get an infiltration rate. You have to take into account how is this water going to flow vertically through a soil formation, whereas the saturated hydraulic conductivity is water flow in any direction.
Oh yeah, and I don't frankly doubt you. But remember where we began. We began with section 5.3.2 in the manual. Let's see, determine infiltration feasibility, and that referred to a particular table in step three. And step three, let's see, this table refers to a measured infiltration rate. So we're not talking about designing the facility. We're just talking about is it even possible to do infiltration? And this one refers to the measured infiltration rate, and it says it's feasible if it's over 5 inches per hour. And I just showed you a section of the appendix which says the ksat is the measured infiltration rate.
Trying to figure out the best way to word this. As engineers, we are responsible for ensuring that any information that we provide is reasonable. It takes into account any and all components that are going to be appropriate, going to be incorporated into a project. And that includes determining an initial infiltration rate. Yes, the code says the ksat is the initial measured infiltration rate. Okay, great. I'm going to take that initial measured infiltration rate and I'm going to apply the necessary engineering requirements that I know as a professional engineer are required for infiltration to determine a measured infiltration rate that should be used in this context. By just taking the ksat, you will drastically overestimate of site's potential to infiltrate because you are ignoring how is that water going to flow vertically from the bottom of any facility into the ground? And by doing that, we end up with sites that should not have extensive infiltration because we've have not accounted for that gradient. And this is really critical because it is one of the reasons that we have so many failed facilities in the region because we didn't take that into account. It wasn't utilized appropriately, and we know this now. And as engineers, using our professional judgment based on what we know, we have got to include that in any recommendation that we put into a report.
Okay, but would you agree with me that the author of this document, the Stormwater Design Manual, when they use the term measured infiltration rate, they mean the initial ksat?
No, it doesn't say that. It just says measured infiltration rate.
And I just showed you a portion of Appendix G, which said that the KSAT is the measured infiltration rate.
Yeah, I believe it said measured initial
In
infiltration.
parentheses, yes, it did. Measured parentheses initial KSAT. Okay. So I guess we'll move on. And then we have the hydraulic, but there is a difference between measured infiltration rate and design infiltration rate, yes?
Yes.
Okay. And so now we get down to the third box, where you're applying the hydraulic gradient, yes?
Yes.
Okay. So, and then we have this particular equation right here, right? Don't know what it means, but I understand it's the gradient. So when I go back through the stormwater design manual, and I move on from, let's see, let's go to Appendix G again. So we were just on step three, determining the measured initial KSAT, and now we're going to go on to step four, calculating the design infiltration rate. Remember, I showed you there were two approaches, simplified and detailed. When I click on the detailed, it just gives me a link to the 2019 ecology manual. So I'm going to click on that. And this is on determining the design infiltration rate. Do you see that?
Yes.
And then I'm going to go down. Let me see here. I think it is. Is that it? Ah, yes. The detailed approach to calculating the design infiltration rate of the native soils. Do you see that?
Yes.
And you see this equation right there?
Yes.
And if I go back to yours, is that the same equation that's right here?
Yes.
Okay. And so the ecology manual says that's the design infiltration rate, but you're saying it's the measured infiltration rate.
I'm saying it is the hydraulic gradient that should be applied to the saturated hydraulic conductivity to determine an infiltration rate, regardless of its design or measured. It should be applied.
Okay, but you will agree with me that the ecology manual refers to it as the design infiltration rate?
The ecology manual put it within the design infiltration rate section. I don't believe they refer to it as the design infiltration rate.
So it says the detailed approach to calculating the design infiltration rate. It says using the detailed approach, estimate the design long term. Because see how it says here, design parenthetical long term? That's sort of like earlier when it said measured parenthetical initial for the KSAT. It says that here, and then it says use this equation.
It says use that equation to calculate the steady state hydraulic gradient.
And so then what else do you have to do to calculate the design infiltration rate?
You have to apply the hydraulic gradient. You have to multiply the hydraulic gradient by the hydraulic conductivity, and then you need to apply the appropriate correction factors, excuse me, in order to determine a design infiltration rate.
Okay. Yes, you're right. So if I go back to yours, this gives you the hydraulic gradient, and then you multiply the K, or in your case, the K equiv, the average, by that, correct?
Yes.
And so here we have, I think your hydraulic gradient is it the
Nope, keep
0.1?
going.
Yeah,
Nope.
this one right here,
There it
the
is.
0.05.
That's it.
And so when you multiply that by the 152.45, you get this 8.6, right?
Yes.
And then you put your adjustment factors in and you get 4.3.
No, there's no adjustment factors. They
Oh,
just
that's
went
just
from
a
feet per day to inches per hour.
Right. Okay. So you take your gradient, which is the 0.056, multiply it by the 152.46, and you get this figure in feet per day. Yes.
Yes.
And then the 4.3 is just the conversion of that to inches per hour.
Yes.
Okay. So my question for you is, you're calling that the measured infiltration rate, but every source that I've shown you says that the measured infiltration rate is this, and that this is the design infiltration rate. Do you just disagree with that?
It doesn't say that 4.3 is the design infiltration rate. You need to apply further correction factors to get the design infiltration rate. That particular portion of the spreadsheet is not included here because I wasn't trying to discuss the design infiltration rate. The design infiltration rate is not shown on this at all.
But the sources I showed you all had the gradient applied at the design infiltration rate stage of the analysis.
And that's fine, but as engineers, as professional engineers who understand soil and groundwater and how everything moves together, we've got to use our professional judgment. And it says that throughout the manuals as well, that
But
we
it
are to use
doesn't,
our
but
professional
it
judgment.
does. Let's go look where it says that. Let's see here. Go back here. Appendix G, roles and responsibilities of licensed professionals. It says this appendix provides the minimum investigation requirements for infiltration, best management practices. This information does not preclude the use of professional judgment to evaluate and manage risk associated with design, construction, operation of infiltration BMPs. You agree with that, right?
Yes.
Doesn't say you get to redefine terms, though, does it?
You've got to use your professional judgment in putting recommendations anywhere. You can't simply blindly follow what has been said before. There are many engineers who agree with me that the saturated hydraulic conductivity is not the infiltration rate. That is well known within our industry. And then we have the additional issues of we have glacially consolidated soils. Those are going to have lower infiltration rates simply because they've been overridden by glacier. We've got to include that in what we're looking at. And we haven't said infiltration is infeasible. We've just said it's not a super high rate. And if we take this back and we take it back even one step further and we go look at that saturated hydraulic conductivity, that 152, that's about 30 inches per hour. That's an infiltration rate that you're going to see in a highly permeable sand and gravel formation that has almost 0% passing the number 200 sieve. That's where we see rates of that level. And those rates, we know that's what we're going to see there. We
Okay.
also know that in areas where we have advanced outwash that has a smaller grain size that has been overridden by glaciers, we are going to have a lower rate. And it is irresponsible of us as engineers to say, yes, an advanced outwash has an infiltration rate of 30 inches per hour. That blanket statement does cannot be applied to all situations. It cannot be applied to all soil formations. And as engineers, I'm not redefining what an initial infiltration rate is. I'm not redefining what a measured infiltration rate is. I am taking the information that we have, and I am saying this is your measured infiltration rate for this formation. And when we go out and we do additional field testing, which has the hydraulic gradient naturally built into it, it is very likely going to confirm this initial testing. And if it doesn't and it's higher, great. We're going to go in and we're going to put some additional facilities in where it's appropriate, where it makes sense based on the grading. And that's what we do as we move through final engineering. So that's, it's something that can be discovered later if absolutely necessary.
So I view this as a textual issue, not an engineering issue. And I understand everything you just said, not to the level that you do, but I think I get the gist of it. But I also understand, correct me if I'm wrong, but is not the point of making the initial feasibility determination to sort of push a developer in a certain position, say, well, if this is feasible, you got to work towards it. Do you agree with that?
I believe that's what we've done here, using reasonable information.
Okay. And so this table, this particular table is th that says when you determine whether infiltration is feasible and when you determine it is not. And that's an important critical juncture in the design of a facility. Would you not agree? Because if it's feasible, you have to start moving in that direction and start trying to accomplish it. Whereas if you determine it's not feasible, you don't. You can just sort of say, hey, we'll do the best we can down the road, but for now, it's not feasible. Right? So it's important to meet this table. And so my question to you is everything that
I'm
I've
going to pause. I'm going to object to this because this is a lot of legal argument. I think counsel just needs to ask the question.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you got to that point. Go ahead, Mr. Talgen.
So on this table, it refers to a measured infiltration rate and it gives you a threshold of 5 inches per hour. The person who wrote this, the person who did it, Were they thinking that you would apply the hydraulic gradient before you even asked whether you met the 5 inches per hour? Or were they thinking that you would apply the hydraulic gradient afterwards? That's the question in my mind. Do you know the answer to that question?
No.
Objection. How could this witness know what the author was thinking,
Because
perhaps?
she could have read the document.
Yeah. Well,
No.
he asked if she knew, and so if she doesn't know, she can just say that. Yeah.
Okay. Do you know?
No.
No. So you're assuming then that the person who wrote this was thinking that you would apply the gradient and then compare that number to this number, right?
I suppose my assumption would be that the author of this would rely on us as professional engineers to use our judgment so that projects are designed in an appropriate manner that will maintain public safety and health throughout the entirety of the project.
But are they not also asking you to determine if an infiltration rate is 5 or more inches per hour or less than 5? Right? I mean, that's the question. Is it 5 or more or is it less than 5? If it's 5 or more, it's deemed by the manual to be feasible. If it's less than 5, it's not feasible. You would agree with me there, at least, right? They're asking you to just simply calculate a number and then compare it to this chart.
Yes.
And when they ask you to calculate that number, are they referring to the initial KSAT or are they referring to that plus the hydraulic gradient?
It says a measured infiltration rate, so I would assume it is the KSAT multiplied by the hydraulic gradient.
And you would assume that even though everything that I have showed you refers to the KSAT as the measured infiltration rate and the hydraulic gradient as part of a separate step to determine the design rate.
Objection asked and answered. Counsel is trying to push the witness into saying something. She's already answered the question multiple times.
I don't know that she has.
I think she has a sustain.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Kolskova, any questions?
I think Ms. Decker, the only question. I had two questions for you. I think you answered one of them, which is if you just used that 152 KSAT number alone as the measured infiltration rate, what is the result of that in terms of projects and infiltration?
Well, we're very likely going to end up with our projects that have far more infiltration facilities in areas that really logically don't end up making sense. And then we've got smaller detention facilities that may be needed. And then as we move towards final engineering and we go out and we get additional data, all of a sudden it's, uh-oh, this doesn't work. Now we've got to redesign the site and now we're losing lots. The storm is completely redone. It could be a very heavy lift if the infiltration is overestimated on a project site.
And so I believe you testified here, the direction you go is essentially to continue to evaluate infiltration as you proceed beyond the preliminary engineering stage.
Yes, we will.
Okay. Is there anything in the manual that suggests, I guess, that you don't have to do that in the future, that you can just ignore this discussion as soon as the preliminary plat is approved in a project?
No, there's nothing to suggest that you ignore this. The manual almost feels like, to me, it directs you to continue to do this as you move towards final engineering.
Okay. I guess in this cross-examination today, was there anything about the review that you've conducted with Mr. Telligan that would change your opinions that you've written in your materials?
No, there's nothing that I've seen that would suggest we need to revise or take a closer look at what we've done.
Right. Thank you. Then I have no other questions for you. Thank you.
Okay, great. Let's move on to Ms. Hebron then, I think at this point, the final witness subject to cross. Thank you, Ms.
Yes,
Decker.
over. Thank you.
And perhaps Is could we get the exhibit number, Ms. Jones, for her document while we're waiting? Assume that's 100, probably.
The Heverin letter is F100.
All right, Ms. Severin, welcome back. Let me swear you in there again. Just raise your right hand. Do you swear affirm to tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Great. All right. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Telgen.
Let's see. Still good morning, Miss Heverin. How are you today?
How are you?
Good. So I'm going to focus first on, let me see here. I'm going to focus on section G of your comment letter, Exhibit 100. This begins on page 3 and runs on to pages 4 and 5. Generally speaking, we're talking here about compliance with minimum requirement 5 of the Stormwater Manual. That's on-site stormwater management, correct? And you chose the list approach.
Correct.
I guess I should pull it up. Just one second. See. Do you recall what section of the
It's PDF page 77 of the manual. I know that.
Yeah, I was trying to use this. I thought it'd be better, but
It's table I 4.2 at the bottom table, second table.
oh, five, yeah. Oh, let's see, 5.1.4.2.
I 4. No, the next one down, tables, not figures.
Ah, there we go. Yes, the list approach. So list approach 2, and so I understand this generally is you sort of look at the different surfaces, hard surfaces or impermeable surfaces in your project site, and this sort of clumps those into different categories. Like I said, I shouldn't say they're all. Some of them are lawns and landscaped areas. That's the first category. Then we have roofs as the second category, and then other hard surfaces as the third category, correct? And I want to start with roofs. For roofs, the way it works is you ask, can you do full dispersion for the roofs or downspout full infiltration? If the answer is yes, that's what you do. If not, you sort of continue going down the list. And at each step, you ask whether or not that BMP is feasible for that type of surface. Is that generally accurate?
Yes.
Okay. And so for roofs, if I go to your comment letter, you talk about roofs. Can you explain to me why full dispersion for roofs is not feasible?
Yeah, so here what I was trying to explain is that if we look at just a grand scale overview of the site and talking about the minimum density of the site, which I think was 158 units. That alone equated to 237,000 square feet of impervious surface. The max amount that you can put in each dispersion trench, dividing that, ended up with 68 dispersion trenches across the site. Now, keep in mind, this is just for the roofs. This doesn't include a driveway, a road to get to it, a sidewalk, anything else.
But the roofs is its own category, right? So you have to ask the question just for roofs.
You do, but how do I build 158 roofs without a road to get to them?
Well,
So
no, I
they're not
understand.
standpoint. They're not standalone. You still have to think of the site wide.
But I mean, for
So,
determining the BMP, you're asking, can we do full dispersion for roofs? Not for roofs plus roads. It's for roofs. That's the first step.
I can't get to the roof without a road. So I do think that they're still included.
Okay,
Regardless of that,
go on.
regardless, the 68 infiltrate or dispersion trenches on the site don't work due to site topography. As I explained in my letter, the slopes of the flow paths are limited to 20% or less for the entire stretch of the 100-foot flow path. The trenches also have to all be 50 feet apart. The flow paths can't cross. There's a number of determining factors that deemed this infeasible as a site-wide BMP. So that's why we did not imply it as a site-wide. We did imply it where we felt that we could make it work with slopes, constraints, and everything else, as mentioned before, with the five dispersion trenches at the northeast corner.
Okay. So in your last testimony, I thought you testified that you couldn't do that. Part of the reason why you couldn't do dispersion is because of the minimum density requirement.
No, I was using the minimum density as an example.
An example of what?
of how many dispersion trenches it would take just to meet minimum density, and that in fact is still infeasible. The number of trenches that it equates to is not feasible on the site.
Okay. So there would actually be, so if you had 158 homes on this project site, there would technically be enough room left over to have 68 dispersion trenches.
I don't believe so, no.
I mean, I'm saying put aside topography. Imagine we're just on a big flat piece of ground, right? If you had 158 homes, you wouldn't have enough room for 68 dispersion trenches?
We're not on a flat site, so I can't throw that out. That's not relevant.
I'm trying to break apart concepts here, though. So I just want to figure out first about just sort of geographic space, then we can talk about topography later. But I mean, if you had 158 homes, would you have enough space left over for 68 dispersion trenches?
By the time you include, again, roofs, or I'm sorry, roads and driveways and all the things to get to these, you can't separate the two.
Well, but okay, I'm on the second step, right? So we're talking about roofs. We're not talking about roads yet. Maybe the roads all go to the offsite pond, right? All the drainage from the roads, imagine it just gets piped to the ponds and goes off someplace else. We're asking whether we can do full dispersion for the roofs. That's the question posed by list approach number two, correct?
That's the question, yes.
Okay, so I'm asking you, if we were to reduce the number of homes on this piece of property from 329 to 158, which is the minimum density requirement, would we have enough room left over to, at least in theory, have 68 dispersion trenches?
I haven't done that exhibit, that math, but and again, I didn't do it because the site constraints and topography weigh in heavily on that. So
right, but
imagining
did...
this as a flat site doesn't give me anything.
So you're saying you didn't testify last time that the minimum lot requirement or the minimum density requirement was an inhibition to doing dispersion for roofs.
I testified that I don't feel that full dispersion is an applicable BMP site-wide, given the topography and given the minimum density with just the 158 homes, that we could not get the dispersion trenches to work.
Okay. So I did do the calculations. Maybe you can tell me if I'm wrong, but the dispersion trench has to be 50 by 100 feet.
Jackson, right? Is counsel testifying that he's an engineer and wants Ms. Hevron to review engineering calculations?
Nope. I can calculate the area of a rectangle, though.
And is this information in the record? I mean, I'm trying to figure out what we're doing here.
Yeah, it's in the record. It's in my brief.
Hypothetical, let me finish, that has nothing to do with this actual project, its topography, the site design, all those considerations.
No. So I want to know if there's enough room. Seems like that'd be an adequate, an important consideration, would it not? We have calculations for how big a dispersion trench is and how much room they take up. So,
Mr. Delligan, you've had a lot of opportunity to make the arguments about this, but this is cross-examination of, what is this, Exhibit F-100 at this point. Counsel's had literally hundreds of pages of testimony and legal argument on these points. We're now cross-examining on this document. This is where we're at.
All right. Mr. Delligan, what part of F-100 is this addressing?
All right. Right here, assuming an average roof area of approximately 30 by 50 feet per lot and using a minimum required site density of 158 lots as specified in Exhibit 50, the total roof area on site would be 237,000 square feet, 158 times 1,500. Given the constraint that each trench can only handle 3,500 square feet, a total of 68 dispersion trenches would be required, each 50 feet by 100 feet long. Furthermore, these calculations... So, I mean... I understand this document to be saying the dispersion trenches will take up a lot of room and there's not a lot of room. I mean, that's what this appears to be saying to me.
Don't we just ask the question of the witness?
Yeah. Okay, well, no, I'll overrule. I'll let him pass his hypothetical back. It's a way of challenging the facts that she's basing her opinion on. So go ahead, Mr. Telgen.
Thank you. So first of all, 329, that's the number of homes that are being proposed, correct?
Correct.
And 158, that's a difference of 171 homes. So you're building 171 homes more than you're required to by code.
Objection, that mischaracterizes code.
I don't know how. We were talking
Again,
about minimum.
Because if we want to get into legal argument here, code allows a minimum and a maximum, and this project is directly within that range. So it is, I don't agree with that's characterizing code. Just ask her the question.
I am asking her the question, okay? It says right here, minimum site density, required site density of 158 lots. I'm just pointing out that you're building 170 more than is required, which is the same word she used.
Minimum.
All right, okay, go ahead and I'll overrule. Go ahead and answer the question, Ms. Hebron.
Can you ask the question again?
You're building 171 more homes than you're required to build under the code's minimum density requirement, right?
We are proposing 329 lots, correct?
Okay. So if you have 68 dispersion trenches, each trench is 5,000 square feet, correct? 50 times 100.
Mm-hmm.
And if I times that by 68, I get 340,000 square feet. Does that sound about right to you?
I have my calculator, but yes, it's about approximately.
Okay. And then if I convert that to acres, I get 7.8 acres. Okay. Do you know how many acres 171 lots takes up?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Do you know if it's more than 7.8 acres?
I would imagine yes.
Okay. So if you were to cut 171 lots, you would have room to put 68 dispersion trenches.
Not necessarily.
Why not?
Because again, site topography. I don't have that much area that's less than 20% slope for the entire length of the flow path, which the flow path has to be perpendicular to the contours. So there's a lot of factors that come into play. It's not just apples to apples math.
Right. And why are you basing this on existing type of topography? Because you're going to be grading this site pretty extensively.
Yes, but there's still extensive slopes that have to be done throughout the site, including walls, in order to maintain the rough topography that is the site. There's road slope constraints. There's all sorts of other constraints that dictate our slopes of our site.
Okay. Have you actually tried to sit down and draw up and see, can I figure out a way to meet the requirements of the code, have 158 homes, 68 dispersion trenches, and work with the topography, either existing or through grading? Have you actually performed that exercise?
I have not.
Okay. Do you know if the roads take up more space than the roofs? Is it more impervious surface or less impervious surface when you compare the roads to the roofs?
I'd have to look. By the way, wait, under 1 second. So we have it broken up slightly differently between pollution generating and non-pollution generating. The pollution generating would be the roadways, non-pollution generating roofways and sidewalks. Pollution generating is slightly less than the non-pollution generating.
Okay. So if you were to do dispersion trenches, if it takes 68 for the roofs, it would take less than 68 for the pollution generating. Because there's less space you're trying to manage runoff from.
Correct. Well, I can't answer that actually, because the way that you size the infiltration trenches, I'm sorry, dispersion trenches is different for a pollution generating surface than it is for a roof.
Okay.
Roof is flat numbers, and the pollution generating you based on flow, and so there's other factors that come into play.
Fair enough. Have you done a calculation to figure out what the total acreage is of dispersion facilities that you would have to accommodate for all of those things together. And I understand I'm asking you basically to now jump ahead to the next step of list two, where you aren't just focused on roofs, but you're asking about other hard surfaces. Do you know how many total dispersion trenches that would take?
We did not do the math because of the topography. We didn't feel it was feasible. So it wasn't necessary.
Okay. Do you know if the total space would be less than 171 lots?
I don't know.
Okay. Sorry. I'm going to jump to page 6 of your. Yes, this is section I of your comment letter. It has to do with pedestrian access along Northwest Island Lake Road. You say that portions of the offsite segment of Island Lake Road were surveyed, revealing that the roadway meanders within the existing right of way. What portions were surveyed?
Approximately half the distance between the intersection of Island Lake Road and Camp Court up to the northwest. It didn't go all the way up to Lake Ridge, went about halfway up to Lake Ridge.
Lake Ridge Circle?
Lake Ridge Circle Northwest, yes.
Okay, so about half that distance. And how much of the roadway was sort of meandered so far that you couldn't put sidewalk in on one side?
It meanders through the roadway, through the right-of-way on either side.
Right. But I guess, you know, what's the total length of roadway where you could put in sidewalks versus where you couldn't put in sidewalks?
I don't have that in front of me right now.
Okay. And then you go on to say that in order then to, or it says, consequently, no feasible location was identified for the construction of a continuous sidewalk extending from Camp Court Northwest to Lake Ridge Circle Northwest without requiring off-site easements from private property. Did you investigate how much it would cost to acquire those easements?
No, that would be beyond my what I would do for a project. That would be up to the developer.
Did the developer do that?
I don't know.
Okay. Did you evaluate, say you didn't get easements, if the road could simply be realigned within the right-of-way?
If the roadway could be realigned within the right-of-way, again, no, because of where the roadway flows through the right-of-way, it still feels that off-site easements would be required to adjust that.
Oh, I thought that because it meandered, you would have to get easements, but you couldn't realign it so that easements would not be required?
I don't know if you could realign it. That we didn't look at that.
Okay. And then it said these easements would be necessary to accommodate vegetation removal, et cetera. Then you say here, given the infeasibility of this offsite connection, a public bus stop was incorporated into the site design to ensure accessibility for all residents and the general public. So I guess I'm wondering, how do you know it's actually infeasible if you don't know if they investigated getting the easements and you don't know if the road could be realigned?
In discussions with the county, the on-site bus stop was a equivalent alternative measure for the off-site sidewalks not being feasible.
Right. So how do you know it's infeasible if you haven't figured out if you can get the easements or how much they would cost, and you don't know if you could just realign the road so you don't have to get easements? How did you actually do the feasibility analysis?
Well, like I said, we surveyed where Island Lake Road currently is and looked at how much between the roadside ditches and how it meanders. We didn't feel that there was a feasible sidewalk location. It wouldn't have to potentially cross Island Lake Road at a mid block, which wouldn't be, which could be a safety concern given the slope and corner of that that roadway. Mm-hmm. So from that, we felt that was infeasible.
Okay. And then you say the public bus stop will provide accessibility for all residents and the general public. What does that mean?
Exactly what it says. The residents in Turtle to the Flat, there are homes adjacent to or right on Camp Court Road that would have access to this, given the new sidewalk. So that would be general public.
Right. So, but you understand the our concern, right, is that, you know, you're increasing traffic quite a bit along Island Lake Road, and there are no sidewalks, very small shoulders. People are concerned about their safety. Are you then suggesting that those people will walk along that same stretch of road to come to your development to ride the bus?
I'm not suggesting that.
Well, doesn't it say here, designed to ensure accessibility for all residents and the general public?
General public with access to the location, correct.
Okay. So not people who live on Island Lake Road.
The pedestrian connectivity or movability along Island Lake Road, whether they come to this bus stop or the existing bus stops, that's I don't know how to answer that without what I've already said, I suppose. But we are providing the mitigation necessary since the off-site sidewalk cannot be achieved.
Okay. And then in the next paragraph, I think you're referring to a section of our comment letter where we pointed out that there's a pedestrian access to Thackeray Place, but there's actually a gap, right? The actual connection doesn't actually reach Thackeray Place. There's a gap between the public right-of-way of Thackeray Place and the pedestrian access you're providing, right?
Yes.
And then you note here that a similar gap exists with regard to the pedestrian connection to the park property, which is adjacent to the school. There you say, thereby preventing complete connection to the school property. Yes?
Yes, but I think what I mean there is that there's not a pedestrian connection to Emerald Heights Elementary. That was what I was trying to emphasize there, is that the pedestrian connections that we are proposing near the park property and near Thackeray Place go up to our property line, because that's where that's where our rights stop. Mm-hmm. They don't have the rights to put a pathway across the county park property.
Yeah. No, I get it. That it's not that your rights end at your property line. Right. I totally get that. But there is a gap at both of those locations.
Yes. I agree.
Yeah. So is the Meadowview proposal actually providing pedestrian access anywhere if those two pedestrian access points have a gap at the end of them before you get to another piece of publicly accessible property?
The pedestrian connection up to the Emerald Heights Elementary was, again, a request from the county for safe walk to schools. We emphasized that this property is not in that school district, therefore is not required. We did opt to put the pathway up to the property line as they requested. And with the pedestrian connection to Thackeray Place, again, we also pointed out that there is not right-of-way connectivity right there. There is a small gap. The county requested that pedestrian connection be put in place. And pedestrian connectivity is still provided on site, given all of the internal sidewalks and to the bus stop.
Right.
I feel like pedestrian connectivity is met.
Fair enough. So whether or not the error was on your part or the county's part, the fact is that while there's internal pedestrian connectivity, the only pedestrian connectivity off the project site is along Camp Court Road to Island Lake Road.
I believe that the pedestrian connectivity is serviced by the on-site bus stop, which would then go off-site.
Right, not to Thackeray Place or to this or to the school property.
I don't know the bus route, but I'm sure.
I mean, walking those the pedestrian paths that lead to Thackeray Place and to the school, they actually don't actually let you get there. They let you get to your property line. You don't actually have access to those properties.
Correct.
Yeah. On page 3. On the ordinary high watermark section of my comment letter, we had pointed out what we thought were discrepancies in how the ordinary high water was demarcated and shown. And I might, if I can find it here. There we go. So this is sheet C1.03 of exhibit F50. I'm just going to zoom in here. So the blue line is the ordinary high watermark. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And then why does it just end right here at this location?
So as I explained in my response letter, at that point, it turns roughly due north because of a bulkhead that exists along the shoreline, along uh-huh. that side of that parcel that's owned by Mr. Clark.
Right. But why is the bulkhead line gray, but the the ordinary high water mark of the lake is this blue dashed line? Like, why is there a difference in denoting that line?
In all honesty, that's probably just an internal difference in our line types, whether it's an actual ordinary high water shot or a feature such as the bulkhead.
But what's the difference between an ordinary high water shot and a bulkhead?
The ordinary high water shots are what we survey. That's either the flagged or whatever demarcation the critical area biologist uses to flag those. So we shoot those locations after they've determined where they are and flagged them. And then at this point where we turn north, Ms. Marlin had indicated that the ordinary high water would follow the bulkhead.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. And so the blue lines of that, does that indicate areas that were actually surveyed?
Yes.
Okay. And when you survey, you say shoot it. Is that like a GPS thing?
It's called a total station. It's not a GPS. It's a physical survey instrument.
Oh, I see. Okay. So you surveyed this. Did you survey the bulkhead?
Yes.
Okay. So that is surveyed as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Back to your... I go to page one. Says here, this is in response to the section of my comment letter talking about shoreline access and the beach and the dock. Do you recall that?
Yes.
And it says here, as indicated during the hearing, the future plans for the dock remain unspecified at this time. Why do they remain unspecified at this time?
I don't know the intention of the future plan for the dock. What I know is that my design and our plans have indicated that we are not using it. There's fencing, there's signage up. We're fencing the entire shoreline, so the use of the dock is not proposed within our project. But what the plan is for the dock, if it's to remain to be taken out, I don't know that.
Okay. But you agree that it's important to preserve that whole area around the dock because that's part of a vegetation conservation buffer, correct?
It's part of the lake buffer, correct?
Right. So wouldn't it be proper then to have a condition to the approval saying the dock will not be used and the beach will not be used? Because you want to protect that area.
Well, there's within code, there is still allowances that area could be impacted in the future. If the dock was chose to be removed, it would still have to go through mitigation. That could be completely separate from the plat. It's not included with this.
But I mean, it shall not, but I mean, I'm saying a condition saying, you know, the dock and the beach shall not be used for recreation. Wouldn't that be consistent with what you're saying? Shouldn't there be a condition saying that?
I don't know that a condition is necessary given that we're fencing the entire thing and signing it.
Did you read the declaration of Dave Charette that was attached to my comment letter?
I believe I did.
Mm-hmm. One of the things he noted was that, you know, on the existing trail that goes around the lake, people have sort of blazed their own trails down the lake and the shoreline is bare and eroded and stuff. I mean, couldn't people do the same thing on your project site? Wouldn't it be better to have an actual condition saying that shall not happen here? People shouldn't be using that area?
Oh, is a condition or words essentially going to stop somebody from going down there versus a fence? I think the fence and the signage would be a lot more applicable.
Yeah, but I mean, your property is not going to be owned forever by Sequoia Springs, right? I mean, it's going to be owned by a home. I mean, there's going to be a homeowners association in charge, individual homeowners. I mean, people that might look back in the future, they might want to see what the plat conditions are, right? And wouldn't it be nice to have something to tell them you shouldn't use this area?
In my mind, I believe that that's the intention of the signage and the fencing. The signs
Okay.
are particular about that these are critical area protection zones.
Okay. What about the bridge?
I believe the bridge is on the other parcel.
Yeah, so if I go back to this area, there's this little, this is exhibit F50 again. I think it's sheet C1.03. You have this little peninsula of land that juts out. You see that? And there's a bridge that connects it over to this location over here, right? What's to prevent people from over here walking along the bridge and then accessing this area?
When that property is developed, when the eastern property is developed, it too would have to provide the same signage and fencing, which would stop that.
Okay, so your belief is that when the eastern parcel, I think it's called the Island Village parcel, when it develops, they will have to sort of keep people out of the shoreline too, and they won't be allowed to go across that bridge onto the Meadowview project site.
Signage and fencing is required along critical area buffers. So the lake buffer would be included in that.
And after assuming that the Meadowview plat is approved, who is ultimately going to end up owning that peninsula of land? So it's outside the project boundary, according to the map. I mean, is Sequoia Springs still going to own it? Will the homeowners association own it? What's going to go on there?
I don't know that.
Okay, and what about up here? Do you know anything about this land up here? If Sequoia Springs will own it still, or if somebody else will own it, or what?
I don't know.
And what about the dock? Because is the dock wholly inside the project boundary?
I don't know where the dock falls on this, within the boundary or not.
Okay, so it could fall outside the project boundary.
Good.
Okay, and so would Sequoia Springs still own the dock even after, you know, this is approved and sold off and there's an HOA and all the lots are owned by other people?
No, I don't know.
Okay. Well, thank you. I have no further questions.
Yeah, Ms. Koloskova?
Thank you. If just a question, the last piece on the dock, if there was any proposal, I guess, related to any aspect of that area, would that have to go, do you know whether that would have to go through any sort of shoreline permitting process?
I imagine it would.
Okay. You haven't looked into anything like that, have you?
No.
Is there any proposal under this project for, there's no proposal under this project at all to use that area, no shoreline substantial development permit, anything like that, right?
Correct.
And that, I presume, goes through the, if something like that were applied for, that would go through, again, the normal public review process.
Objection. Right? She just said she hadn't reviewed it.
Fine. I'll withdraw it. Okay. Stand for itself. I agree with you. one last question on those access points on the site, which would connect to the property boundaries of the school property and Thackeray Place. Why do you show those on the project? What is the purpose of doing that?
They were a request from the county.
Okay, so that would allow an opportunity in the future then for someone to connect to those if they wanted to? Or, I mean, what happens with those?
Yeah, presumably. I mean, the county owns the park's property. County Parks Department owns the park property between the school and the one pet connection that we are proposing.
Okay. So this would at least allow the ability for a connection in the future as opposed to precluding it. I don't have any other questions for you. Thank you.
Okay. Well, that was pretty good timing then. I think we are done with this proceeding, it looks like, right? We've got the closing arguments in. We have the cross-examination in. So at this point, it's just balls in my court now to write that decision in the next couple of weeks. So got a bit of work ahead of me there. So yeah, that decision will be due in 10 business days. And you know, as I get in the middle of it, I notice I might ask for a couple more days. I don't know. We'll see how it goes, how much time this takes. There's a lot of the technical issues I'm gonna have to look into. I look forward to it. It's just an issue. I have several other multi-day hearings going at the same time. So, but I'll get that 10 days or close to it. So anyway, thanks all for your patience in a very I think you know it's turned out to be fairly complicated. Very interesting, very important hearing. I recognize there are some, you know, very important issues to the residents around the lake, and of course, going to take that very seriously, and have to become somewhat of an expert hydrologist over the next couple of weeks. So, thank you all again, as usual, for all your competence, civility, and professionalism. It's been, you know, really well presented case, and I look forward to jumping into it. So. Anyway, I think with that, we are finally adjourned with Meadowview. So thanks all for participating. We're done.
Thank you.
Bye.